From Ricky Renuncia to Ricky Se Fue. Puerto Rico Governor Ricardo Rosselló has resigned after days of massive protests against his government. It's the takeaway for July 25th. Also on the show, the Trump administration wants to change the eligibility requirements for food stamps to close what they say is a loophole.
This administration has tried to legislate against SNAP dollars since the beginning, and this is kind of an end run. This is a way to do it without any kind of congressional oversight.
It would mean 3 million fewer people would receive the benefit.
Food stamps account for about half of my family's grocery budget. Losing them would put us in a large financial strain.
Plus, we'll talk Tarantino's new flick with our movie folks, Rafer Guzman and Allison Wilmore. All that and a bag of chips. Let's get to it. Last night, the Puerto Rican people finally had their voices heard. In an unprecedented turn of events, Governor Ricardo Rosselló resigned from his position following 12 days of protests that have filled streets on the island and around the world.
Con desprendimiento, hoy les anuncio que estaré renunciando al puesto del gobernador efectivo el viernes 2 de agosto del 2019 a las 5 de la tarde.
After hours of anticipation, Rosselló released a recorded statement. He did not, however, address the crowds or the media directly. Here's the moment in Old San Juan as protesters received the news.
Que estaré renunciando al puesto del gobernador.
Governor Rosselló has been under intense scrutiny after his handling of the island's debt crisis and his reaction to Hurricane Maria. But the final straw was a trove of leaked messages published this month in which the governor and members of his cabinet joked about the hurricane's victims and made sexist and homophobic comments. Calls for Rosselló to step down grew even louder yesterday after lawyers commissioned by the Puerto Rican House of Representatives found the governor had potentially committed 7 crimes related to those leaked messages. Then the Speaker of Puerto Rico's House gave Rosselló an ultimatum. Step down or impeachment proceedings would continue. The resignation has rocked the political system on the island. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. We've got a lot to talk about, and you can find all of our coverage so far at thetakeaway.org/Puerto Rico. Joining us to discuss all of this is David Begno, lead national correspondent for CBS This Morning. Thanks for being with us, David.
Absolutely.
And Bianca Padro Ocasio is a reporter with the Miami Herald. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Bianca.
Thank you for having me.
David, Ricky Se Fue, you've been on the scene. Tell us about the agonizing wait for the announcement and how people reacted in that recording that you sent after the after his statement.
Well, you know, it was interesting. It was almost as if we were made to feel like fools. So we hear that, you know, there's going to be a resignation based on the reporting of 2 major outlets on the island. They took the lead on this. El Nuevo Día and El Vocero said that they had reporting that the governor was going to resign. Well, his staff wouldn't say a word. They wouldn't confirm anything, nothing. So we get there and they're like, yeah, no, we don't have anything for you. And then all of a sudden they come running out and they say, come in here, come in here. And they corral everyone inside, but they don't tell us what's going to be said. They don't tell us who's going to be saying it. They don't tell us what time it's going to be delivered. It was the most bizarre thing, and they kept us waiting there for an hour and a half. Now, the governor's bodyguards came in, so you assume that the governor's going to come in. Well, come to find out, it apparently was a game. The governor wanted to play one last game with everybody before he left, and that's how he actually exited, was while all the media was in the room waiting for someone to come and make a statement. They eventually said, it was a press secretary or the secretary of public affairs who said, hey, he'll make a statement later. It ended up being a pre-recorded statement delivered around 11:30 p.m., and when that was received, it wasn't just euphoric. It wasn't just, and that's not my opinion. I'm describing the people there. It wasn't just euphoric. It was historic. There were tears in the eyes of Residente, the well-known rapper, who said it's the best thing that's happened. My son was delivered. There were tears in the eyes of the man who got up on a police barricade. He spent millions of dollars helping to evacuate people after Hurricane Maria, and he came back there last night to be with the people when the news was unveiled. There was the teacher in the crowd who talked about how much it meant, the fact that she's out of work and schools had been closed by an education secretary who the governor appointed, and that education secretary was arrested by the FBI 3 weeks ago, charged with corruption. It was really something to witness. And I have to tell you, I think more than anything, one of the most moving things was that you could tell last night when the people heard the governor say, "I plan to resign," for the first time in a long time, they felt heard. They felt heard by their government, who they were able to shame enough to drive him out of town.
Bianca Wanda Vasquez is in line to succeed Rosselló as, and she's Puerto Rico's Secretary of Justice. Can you tell us, I mean, there are already calls for her to step down. Is she expected to stay in power?
Well, you know, it's pretty hard to tell the day after Rosselló announces his resignation. But, you know, she is a pretty controversial figure in Puerto Rico, especially among women and feminist groups, because she worked in the office for, you know, women's rights in the government. And as feminist groups have been calling for a state of emergency to address domestic violence on the island, she remained silent for a long time. And then she went on to become the Secretary of Justice. She's also had clashes with the Senate President, Tomás Rivera Schatz. So it's unclear, you know, whether she has the backing of the legislature, whether she has the backing of the people. Last night, as David said, you know, people did feel heard. They were chanting, "There's more of us and we're not afraid." But they were also chanting for her to resign. So it'll be interesting to see in the next few days how this plays out and, you know, whether people will keep showing up to the streets. Because there's also, although there is a lot of celebration, there's still a sense of, you know, this is just the beginning of something. We realize that there is a government that is stepping on us, but now we have to keep going because there's more of them.
David, I'm wondering, Rosselló was pretty adamant and at least about not stepping down for these past 12 days now. What he continued to do was lose the support of his own party. He lost the support of pretty much everybody, including Walter Mercado, who's a big cultural figure. Was that the final straw and not the protest? Do you have any sense of that?
No, because I haven't been able to talk to anybody who was advising him, right? I'd really like to know who thought it was a good idea for him to go on Fox News and interview with Shepard Smith, because if he thought he was going to get a softball interview with there, he was sorely mistaken. And the interview is almost uncomfortable to watch as the governor sort of fumbles all over himself and then says one supporter he does have is the mayor of San Sebastian, who turns out didn't support him. I don't know who was advising him. I will tell you, he has been described by insiders. Insiders told me that the governor has been sort of alone on an island with very few people to sort of lean on. I would think his father, the former governor, a two-term governor, has been a very valuable mentor, if you will, or shoulder lean on. But I got to tell you, I don't know, because talking to his staff, I mean, they were dropping like flies. The chief of staff resigned the day before. His press secretary is gone. The chief financial guy is gone. I mean, the guy was nearly by himself.
Mm-hmm. And Bianca, speaking of that, do we know what the fallout for any of those government officials has been so far? Some of who, as David mentioned, had already been arrested, some of whom have just stepped down, including his Secretary of State. Where are they now? Do we have any sense?
That's difficult to know. I mean, right now there's an ongoing investigation in the Justice Department linked to the leaked chats. There's a sense that, you know, there was confidential information that was shared with private citizens, and that was not just pretext for the legislature to act on a potential impeachment, but it's also something that will potentially be investigated criminally. So, you know, it's hard to tell right now exactly where these people are. There were a few people on his staff, including his former chief of staff, Ricardo Gerandi, who was on TV yesterday, kind of circling the morning shows, talking about the governor and how he had had a process of introspection. So, you know, I don't know exactly what the fallout will be, but I don't think that this is the last that we've heard of any of these figures, especially the ones who've resigned in the aftermath of the chat.
David, you've been covering Puerto Rico for quite some time, particularly in the fallout after Hurricane Maria. Let's go back a minute to Rosselló's legacy, if you will. We saw the ramping up of the economic crisis during his administration, the appointment of the Promesa board, which many have also called for them to be disbanded, and of course, the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. What is Rosselló's legacy at this point?
His legacy may be being the best known Puerto Rican governor outside the island. You'd be hard pressed to find Americans living stateside who aren't Puerto Rican, who could tell you who the governor of Puerto Rico is or a past governor. But Rosselló became someone who people came to recognize as a result of what happened during Hurricane Maria, the airtime that he got, the crusade that he made to get money for the island and resources to arrive here and help the people. But I think he'll also be remembered for such an incredible fall from grace. Remember, this is the son of a former two-term governor of Puerto Rico, a man who the people called the Messiah. That's what they called the elder Rosselló, Pedro Rosselló. And this younger Rosselló, Ricardo Rosselló, was a charismatic, you know, handshaking, baby-kissing kind of guy who early on folks were like, he doesn't have the experience. He's got the charisma and he has sort of these Hollywood commercials, but he doesn't have the experience. But guess what? He got elected. And to have such an incredible fall from grace is really astounding. In all fairness, we should be fair about this, though. His supporters will tell you that he was dealt such a devastating hand by being a new governor who had just come into office and had to deal with the aftermath of Hurricane Maria, which would have been difficult for anybody. His supporters will say he implemented some things and did some things that were good and were wonderful, and he should be credited for that.
Bianca, I want to wonder as far as like where the island goes from here in terms of its political parties. We know the Popular Democratic Party and the PNP, the Partido Nuevo Progresista, have been largely the two main parties on the island. But where do those parties stand today? Is there any sense that the PPD, for example, might gain in popularity given the PNP's connection with Rosselló?
To be honest with you, and this is probably the most interesting thing that I keep hearing through all of this, I think that there's a sense among people that, you know, of course, you know, Rosselló is this person who symbolizes a lot of corruption and a lot of mistrust in the government, but there is a lot of mistrust in the two major parties because there's a sense that every 4 years, people vote for the same people, the same parties, and this is a cycle of corruption that is ongoing. And this is something that is talked about. It's very part of Puerto Rico's culture when we talk about politics. So the fact that people are actually saying, you know what, in the next election, we will not allow to be stepped on. We will not allow to be taken by fools again. I think that there's a sense that there are other parties, there are other proposals, political proposals that are now on the table in a serious way. And I want to say in the past two elections, there have been several, very minority parties that are not necessarily linked to a question of status for the island, because the three major parties have always represented statehood, independence, and status quo. So, you know, now there's a sense of we will not vote for the same people. We want to see new proposals. We want to see people who are not, that we haven't seen before.
Bianca Padro Ocasio is a reporter with the Miami Herald. David Begno is the lead national correspondent for CBS This Morning, and we appreciate you both for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And we're joined now by Francis Negon Muntaner, a Puerto Rican filmmaker, writer, and scholar, and professor at Columbia University Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race. Great to have you back with us, Francis.
Thanks so much for having me.
So today is so many things, historical importance when it comes to Puerto Rico. Andrea Gonzalez Ramirez, who's at Refinery 29, tweeted out this morning, it's July 25th, which marks 121 years since the U.S. invaded Puerto Rico, 67 years since the colony became a commonwealth, and on and on. Let's talk about the historical importance of this day as it relates to Rosselló's resignation.
Well, first, we would say that this moment is, of course, the product of many historical forces and prior forms of organizing along different lines, including anti-colonial, labor, anti-military, feminist, queer. But it's also new and different. For instance, the forms of organizations that have emerged are leaderless, horizontal, decentralized, and heavily participatory. So I think one of the major legacies of this moment will be that the people of Puerto Rico have, in fact, reconstituted themselves and articulated an entirely different way that they want politics to go forth.
And some folks have compared this, and we talked about this a little while ago, to the Arab Spring and other big social movements throughout history. We know Black Lives Matter was similarly leaderless in the beginning, and that was almost by design. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's totally by design. People are communicating, but there is a plurality of organizations and groups involved. And the gist of the entire enterprise is precisely to bring a new politics into being, one that's not hierarchical, that is not top-down, that's certainly not colonial, and that is not driven by coloniality, that is the privilege of white men, heterosexual, and so forth. So I think that's definitely akin to other movements that have been taking place all over the world, including the United States.
Let's talk a little bit about, we just ended the segment earlier talking about the news of Rosselló stepping down. But where does this leave the future of Rosselló's party, the pro-statehood party? And then there's the party, the PDP, that is all for the status quo, Commonwealth. And there's always been this sort of smaller third party wanting independence. Do we expect a new party to emerge from this, a new political party to come out of this?
That's certainly something that can happen. Before I talk further about this, I should say that the protests are also about the rejection of the current two-party system dominance, a rejection of that, a rejection of the political parties themselves, and the way that they have basically dedicated themselves to, quote-unquote, manage the colony and deplete and plunder its resources. So I think that it's interesting to me that the question of electoral politics of a new party hasn't really emerged as central in the protest. But I do think that if we consider what happened in the prior elections, when independent candidates not affiliated with the dominant parties amassed about 17% of the vote, I think we can anticipate that new political parties may emerge for the next elections. And in fact, there's already one group, Victoria Ciudadana, that has been articulating an agenda for a different political party.
One of the things that we heard after Maria, when we went down to the island to visit and do reporting out in the one-year anniversary, was this question of whether Puerto Rico was better off as an independent nation or really just becoming part of the United States, formalizing this relationship. Where do you see either of those ideologies headed?
Well, I think that what people want and what I feel that there is an enormous consensus for is a process of self-determination. I don't think there's a clear outcome that we can anticipate from that. But I think that where this is heading or where a lot of people are saying, this is how we want to build on what we have achieved. One, we want an audit and cancellation of the debt. And it's pretty much in this order, you know. Two, we want to abolish or dismantle the control board. We want more of this process to be, or all this process to be, in the hands of Puerto Ricans. And then end of colonialism and a true and just form of self-determination where people can, in fact, assemble and assess and deliberate on what kind of relationship they might want with the United States.
So I was just going to ask you about that. I mean, how do we see the island's relationship with the federal government of the United States emerging out of these protests?
Well, I think one of the things that's very important to say is that the protests themselves were a space where people, in fact, were decolonizing themselves. In all kinds of ways, not only in the sense of the traditional status politics way, but in their bodies, in their sexuality, in their gender identity and relations. But I think for Washington or for the U.S. more generally, this is also should be a moment of decolonization because it's always Puerto Ricans are a bit ahead in that process. In the United States, there's still a resistance even to acknowledge that Puerto Rico and other U.S. territories are colonies. There is practically no conversation about how the U.S. itself can move to a decolonized future in its relationship to what are called unincorporated territories. And some of the ways that the U.S. can start moving in that direction is, for instance, parity of federal funds, remove the control board, more support for rebuilding and reconstituting a different and better Puerto Rico. So I would say that that's would be next, rather than jump to what the conclusion of a self-determination process might be. I think what we need to engage is in a process of decolonization on both sides.
Francis, we got about a minute left in the segment, but this is something that has expanded beyond the island of Puerto Rico into the diaspora and around the world. Where do you see that? How do you see that relationship evolving with Puerto Ricans who live around the world, who are in the diaspora?
Yeah, one of the most incredible parts of this process was to see the diaspora in action and in a different way than before, because mainly when we think about the diaspora, we think about the people that are settled in the United States for obvious reasons. They're the largest number and the closest in relation in history. But this process demonstrated that there are Puerto Ricans all over the world and that they are equally diasporic in the sense that they are still maintain very deep connections to their homeland and are participating and doing things sometimes that people in Puerto Rico cannot do because of where they are positioned. So I think in the future, one of the aspects that people are going to have to think through is how does this reality of people living in Puerto Rico and outside is nurtured and supported in any status conversation that take place about the future of Puerto Rico.
Francis Negron Muntaner is a professor at Columbia University Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race. Francis, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And you can find all our coverage on this story at thetakeaway.org/Puerto Rico. Earlier this week, the Trump administration proposed a rule change that could push more than 3 million people off of food stamps. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says it will eliminate a loophole that they say allows people who don't currently need food stamps to abuse the program. It would make 8% of people who are currently getting assistance no longer eligible for food stamps. It's the latest move by the White House to try and enact major cuts to benefits programs. And joining me now to discuss is Washington Post reporter Laura Riley. She covers the business of food. Laura, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
So can you explain the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the loophole that they're saying it allows people to abuse the program? What are they referring to there?
It's called the broad-based categorical eligibility loophole, a big mouthful.
Okay.
But what it means essentially is states adopt this. 43 states and territories have adopted it. It's a way to cut down on paperwork essentially, so that if you qualify for these temporary assistance for needy family program, small financial assistance payments, or these other maintenance of effort payments, these are kind of short-term stopgap. You're back to work, but you know maybe you can't pay your child care, or maybe your transportation is a little beyond your means. So it's these small bits of money. So if you qualify for those, you are automatically eligible for SNAP, for food stamps. So they're saying that states have abused this and that individuals have abused this, and this is a way to go back to a system where everybody has to qualify individually for SNAP or separately for SNAP.
So let's talk about what that means in real dollars. What is the real sort of threshold for someone to qualify for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program or SNAP, known as food stamps?
So it's 100. The cutoff is 130% of the poverty line. So this is not a lot of money. The issue that people have with the system as it is that some people who have a very modest amount of savings, let's say $2,200, might still with this loophole might still be eligible for SNAP, or if you have assets above a certain level, but I think that a lot of people who have been in support of this, if you want to call it a loophole, this broad-based categorical eligibility, is that it favors people who are getting back to work. So families, working families, or the elderly who may have a modest amount of savings, or those on disability. So it will basically cause people to either draw down their savings or reduce their hours at work so that they can qualify.
And let's talk a little bit about the quote-unquote abuse here. Is there any evidence that people are abusing food stamps? I mean, how much does an average person get when it comes to food stamps? And how could they abuse that?
It's not a ton of money. It's a few hundred dollars. But for the people who need it, it's you know, incredibly meaningful. So, yes, there is some abuse. There was a very famous situation a few weeks ago. This is what they called the Minnesota millionaire came forward to say that despite the fact that he has lots of assets and lots of savings, he qualified for SNAP because of this loophole and was on food stamps for 19 months. Kind of a stunt. I don't know all of the particulars. I'm sure there are some people who have qualified for SNAP that perhaps have assets, savings, property, whatever, that might not be appropriate, but this particular decision will throw 3 million people, largely working families, off, and as well as 300,000 kids off of the school lunch program.
Laura Riley covers the business of food for The Washington Post. Laura, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me today.
We're going to continue our look at SNAP benefits, focusing now on Mississippi, the state with the highest rate of food insecurity in the country. 21.5% of Mississippi's population receives food stamps, and the USDA's new proposal could make a portion of them ineligible for their benefits. Joining us now to talk about SNAP and food insecurity in Mississippi is Tyson Jackson, the program coordinator at Jackson Meals Matter, which helps to ensure food security, especially for children in Jackson, Mississippi. Tyson, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So why is food insecurity such a problem in Mississippi?
I think it comes from a long history of, you know, Mississippi being a low-income state for most of the residents, moving from agriculture, industrial, and that way it kind of missed us down here when it comes to the Industrial Revolution. So we've still been an agricultural state. Agricultural states tend to be, you know, less income for people because it's less jobs. I think that where it comes from at the beginning, but also if we look at Mississippi, it has a history of horrible policies against poor and working people.
Tell us about what the demographics of the people who receive SNAP benefits are in Mississippi. Who is the typical SNAP receiver?
I think the typical SNAP receiver in Mississippi, it's going to be more of, you know, your working people, working families when it comes to it. And we look at the demographics, increasingly African-American in Mississippi, but it doesn't just mean it's isolated in our community. I think all communities that are dealing with poverty are stricken by this and are SNAP recipients.
And when you were speaking to our producers, you told them that you grew up in a family that received food stamps, and in college you received SNAP benefits. Tell us what that was like. What was it like to have to really live with that reality?
When growing up, when I was a kid, you know, I didn't know any different. I mean, I know we had food on the table, and I know my mother did a lot to make sure that I was taken care of, and even had enough where we were able to feed neighborhood kids when they came over, and it was just kind of like a community. So we didn't really see things, well, I didn't see things at that perspective of we were poor or we didn't have anything. I guess when I got to college and I wasn't under my mother's roof anymore and I had to start to try to figure out how to do this on my own, you know, we're looking at our meal plans, we're looking at other things, and I just didn't have the money to make it all the time. SNAP became an option. And I remember going to the office and I was quite embarrassed at first to go and sign up for SNAP. But my mother, she told me back then, she was like, you know, what you're doing now will help you help someone else in the future. And lo and behold, that's exactly what my life end up doing. I work now to help people that are in the same predicaments, especially even college students. And I think, you know, as we talk about this, can't escape the fact that college students are a big part of the base that's being attacked by this proposed legislation.
Let's talk a little bit more about the proposed legislation. The estimates are that at least 3 million people around the country could lose their SNAP benefits. Tyson, what would that look like in Mississippi?
it would be devastating to Mississippi. I mean, we have some people here that are just now getting things together to get there and then be knocked back down by this. It seems evil. I mean, it's morally reprehensible.
Tell us a little bit about what someone needs to do in order to get SNAP benefits in Mississippi today. What are the eligibility requirements? And then what does it look like? Like, what does your shopping cart look like once you have SNAP?
I'm glad you asked that, too, because we look at in Mississippi, we look at the proposed law. And I say a little bit about, you know, when you ask me what it looked like in Mississippi, where it already looks like that. In 2017, our legislature actually passed a policy that is very similar to what they're trying to do on a federal level now, stepping in access to SNAP benefits for anyone that needs to get SNAP benefits. It's been pretty hard for people here in the first place. So when we look at what people will be suffering with and what they will be dealing with when it comes to this new legislation, it's going to be very, very hard for us, period, down here in Mississippi.
Tyson Jackson is the program coordinator for Jackson Meals Matter in Jackson, Mississippi. Tyson, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Do you have any experience in motion pictures?
Active renter at Blockbuster.
Can we talk about something other than Hollywood for a change?
Ms. Taken. You know Mr. Taken from the Taken movies. This is his niece.
The studio makes pictures to serve the system.
Your job is to rate movies on a scale from good to excellent.
Hollywood has always loved making movies about, well, Hollywood. And few directors have made their love of cinema more apparent than Quentin Tarantino. This week, he's out with a new movie that places the golden age of Hollywood front and center. Here's a moment from it.
And if your dudes were a better match for me, I'd say, oh, okay, you got me. But that's not the case, and you know it. He's a great match for
me.
Hey, you could do anything you want to him. Throw him off a building, right? Light him on fire. Hit him with a Lincoln, right? Get creative. Do whatever you want. He's just happy for the opportunity.
That was Leonardo DiCaprio as actor Rick Dalton talking about his loyal stuntmen played by Brad Pitt in Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And while those central characters are fictional, the movie also features Margot Robbie as real-life actress Sharon Tate, who was murdered by members of the Manson family in 1969. Tarantino's decision to dramatize Tate's life and death has been raising some eyebrows in the run-up to the film's release. When Once Upon a Time in Hollywood premiered in May, a New York Times reporter asked the director why Margot Robbie, as Tate, has relatively few lines in the film. Tarantino declined to answer the question.
Well, I just reject your hypotheses.
It's not the first time Tarantino and his work has been subject to scrutiny, especially when it comes to portrayals of women, his depictions of Black American culture, and the use of racial slurs. And I have two guests joining me now in the studio. Rafer Guzman is film critic for Newsday and The Takeaway. Welcome, Rafer.
Hi, Tanzina.
And Allison Wilmore is a critic and culture writer for BuzzFeed News. Great to have you back, Allison.
I'm so happy to be here.
So let's start with both of your takes on the film, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Allison, did you like it?
I did like it.
You did?
I liked it more than I actually had anticipated and more than I've liked his last three movies. So this is the first time in a while where I felt like Quentin Tarantino has made a movie that felt populated by actual human beings.
Wow. Okay. Yes. Rafer, what about you? Did you like it? Thumbs up?
Yeah, I was a little different than Allison. It was sort of more of a slow burn for me. I kind of walked out of the movie feeling a little bit on the fence, but then it's really stuck with me. And in the end, I really felt like, you know, even though it may not be his strongest work, I really felt like he's still a great filmmaker and it's a really fun ride.
We're going to get into some of the more controversial elements of Tarantino and his work. And at the top, we mentioned his depiction of Sharon Tate and her murder. That's generated a lot of controversy among those who haven't actually seen the film yet. What did you both make of Tate's role in the film?
Well, I think it would be a mistake to describe the movie as one that's specifically about her or about the Manson murders. Her story kind of runs in parallel to the main friendship that is between these two men that is the focus of the story. And, you know, it's about their kind of relationship and about how they're both kind of fading out of Hollywood at this particular time that's like in between eras. It's really a love letter to kind of not great TV, forgettable TV. But I think it's pretty tender and thoughtful with Tate in terms of trying to kind of pull her away from this horrifying death that has come to be her, like, main reason she's remembered. She becomes this person, you know, and I don't think she's the main focus of the film, but she's kind of allowed to be a three-dimensional character.
There's another thing that's come up throughout Tarantino's career, and that's the frequent use of the N-word in his films, and particularly when his white characters say it. Is that something that makes it hard to sort of go back and watch some of his previous movies, Reefer, like Pulp Fiction and Django Unchained and things like that?
You know, not for me. I think Django Unchained, it is a problematic film, I think, because it is so violent, and I think people scratch their heads a little bit. The same way they did a little bit with Inglourious Basterds. You know, why is Quentin Tarantino, a white guy, taking on this black story? So, you know, he's not Jewish. Why is he taking on this Jewish story in Inglourious Basterds? But I don't think that means he had bad intentions, and I think Quentin Tarantino was doing this kind of thing long before there was this big push of pressure on Hollywood to do these things, to cast a black male action hero, to cast Uma Thurman, a woman as an action hero in the two Kill Bill films. I think he was doing this kind of stuff a little bit ahead of his time, frankly.
Reefer, you mentioned Uma Thurman. He's made several movies starring Uma Thurman. Those movies were all produced by Harvey Weinstein. And here's what Thurman said on a red carpet around the time that the Weinstein scandal first broke in October 2017.
When I've spoken in anger, I usually regret the way I express myself. So I've been waiting to feel less angry. And when I'm ready, I'll say what I have to say.
In an interview with the New York Times in February 2018, Uma Thurman talked about being assaulted by Harvey Weinstein. She also said that she was pressured by Tarantino to do a dangerous car stunt while she was filming Kill Bill. Allison, remind us what happened there.
Well, she, you know, had pushed back. She said she was not a stunt person. She didn't want to do this stunt. And there was a crash and she injured herself and had a concussion, you know. And I think when you read that story, a lot of the pain is not just the injury, but the fact that Quentin Tarantino was so kind of unapologetic about it. He didn't show, like, refused to share the footage with her, you know, for years. She had to really fight. And it was a huge betrayal of this collaboration. You know, they created the character of the bride together. And I think it's hard to watch those movies, which I've loved those movies, you know, and I think he put so many kind of great, complicated women on screen. At the same time, you can't not think about that when you watch them.
You hinted, Reefer, at the fact that this might be one of the last Tarantino films that we get to see. I mean, and Tarantino has said in the past that he plans to retire after directing 10 films. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is number 9.
Yep.
Whether or not he does retire, where does Tarantino fit into the Hollywood of 2019 and beyond? And I'll pose that question to both of you.
You know, for me, he's one of the last true cinephiles and one of the last real filmmakers around. I was just thinking to myself when I walked out of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood about, God, what would happen if Netflix got a hold of him? That would just be it would kill me. I don't think that's going to happen because I think he's a real holdout. And one of the things I loved about this film was it just felt like a real movie. You know, I love the Marvel movies, but those are widgets out of a factory. And this was a real person's vision, an original screenplay. My God, an original screenplay.
Shocking.
And, you know, and it just, for all its flaws, it still grabbed me and it still felt like one person's vision up on the screen. And I loved that. And that's one of the things I love about Tarantino.
Yeah, he's made a lot of work I've loved, but I think also you have to think of him as maybe this one of the last holdouts of the director as this kind of godlike figure as well. And there are negative parts of that that have include, you know, what happened to Uma Thurman, include how, you know, back in 2003, he like wrote off the Polanski rape. He since apologized for it, but he was very much like dismissive of it, you know, and the way that he has said that he knew more than just rumors about Harvey Weinstein, but chose not to speak up because Harvey Weinstein was, you know, his great champion. And I think there is something about that attitude that I am glad to see go, in that you are willing to allow other people to get hurt on behalf of your own work. And I think, you know, you lose things with that in terms of this kind of great author of a filmmaker who has this incredible vision. At the same time, you gain some things in terms of just protecting other people who work with you. That mindset is slowly kind of going away.
All right. Reefer Guzman is film critic for Newsday and The Takeaway. Allison Wilmore is a critic and culture writer for BuzzFeed News. Thanks to you both. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's all for us today. Amy Walters in tomorrow. I'm back on Monday. And we want to give a shout out to our people here at The Takeaway making you the show this week. Our producers are Lee Hill, Alexandra Boti, Isabel Angel, Ethan Oberman, Jose Olivares, Jason Tureski, Danny Lewis, and Andres O'Hara. Polly Arungu is our digital editor. Our engineer and sound designer is Vince Fairchild. Our director and sound designer is Jake Howitt. And Jivika Varma is our intern. David Gable is our wonderful assistant and our staff baker. Call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.